Hello and welcome to episode 16 of White Line Wireless's AIF 11 Cricket Tour podcast. My name is Anthony Condon and joining me again this week is Cam Boyle.
Thank you again, Anth.
Good to see you, Cam, back for another dose of some 1919 cricket. Once again, we're going to read through one of Cal Corner's diary and reflect on what he talks about. The diaries, of course, are fictional, but they've been put together using real quotes from real people. And you can go to my website, anthonycondon.com, and there you'll actually be able to put your mouse over each quote and it pops up the newspaper or the diary or whatever it comes from. Also, a bunch of photos and the like on there. Some great photos on this week's one, the Clifton College Close Ground. But today, 31st of August, so getting towards the end of the tour. We've only got a couple of weeks left in England. And this week we have two games. We have two 2-day games. A 2-day match against Gloucestershire at the Clifton College Close Ground. And a 2-day game against Somerset at the County Ground at Taunton. Lots to talk about this week, so we might jump straight into Cow Corner. The final county games of the tour have ended in rain. At Bristol for the Clifton Festival, the Australians were saved from their third day defeat by the clerk of the weather. And on the first day at Taunton, in the last match of Somerset County, there was only sufficient time in which to complete the Australian innings before play stopped for the day. Somerset cracked up so sadly on the second day that they failed hopelessly and were well beaten by 95 runs a quarter of an hour before time.
I just want to quiz you a little bit there on Anth on the term clerk of the weather. I've heard of Father Time, I've heard of Mother Nature, but clerk of the weather, that's just depressing. Has the weather been, you know, given so lowly a position amongst the various elemental creations that apparently it's only justified to be done by a person wearing pens in their pocket or something like that in an office underground?
It is interesting. It is. Well, I mean, if you imagine that the world is run by supernatural beings and they have their places and, you know, Mother Nature obviously is Mother Nature and Father Time, like that, you know, time is so important. You can quite see the person who runs the weather as being quite an uptight bureaucrat with his pocket protector who, you know, it's like, no, it has to rain. It has to rain today. I do not care. It is on my schedule for rain. We cannot avoid this. Yes, I know it's your wedding, but that doesn't matter. There is no irony involved. It is just the way the schedule works.
Sorry, if we've got a clerk of the weather then yeah, I'm going to place us here, but then what the heck do you explain Melbourne then? I mean, the clerk must be either drunk or, I don't know, on some sort of hallucinogens to explain the weather that we've got here.
Unless it's like, you know, unless it's a, you know, this supernatural world is one of these places that has a very strong public sector union. Ooh. So it's impossible to be fired, and so the only way you can get rid of someone is basically to promote them to another department. And so maybe the clerk of the weather has Ivanka Trumped and failed their way all the way up to becoming the person who runs the weather, when really they probably should have been fired from their job as the tea boy.
Or perhaps it's someone who just wants to be fired and is just screwing around with the weather right now. Just go, well, come on, guys. I'm desperate for some time off. I've been doing this shit for hundreds of years.
Maybe that's what climate change is. Climate change is caused by this supernatural clerk of the weather who is trying to get fired. So he's just been sitting there just slowly cranking.
Just cranking it.
See
if anyone notices.
See if anyone notices.
Maybe it's a dare.
Yeah.
You know, there's some really dissatisfied public servants or something like that just currently operating the weather going, mate, if I just like up at a degree each year, when do you think the boss is going to notice?
Yeah, and they're still going, and they're like, these people aren't. No one's doing it. People are noticing, but no one believes. Like, it's.
They keep giving all these bad reasons for it. What the fuck are these humans doing?
Forget the science. We have solved climate change.
Done. Brilliant. That's why you come to these podcasts.
So I think I also said that the Gloucestershire game was a 2-day game, but I think it was a 3-day game that with the third day rained out. So there's actually not a lot more on the cricket games this week. So we might jump over and start off by having a chat about how these two games went. So we kicked off at Gloucestershire at the Clifton College Close Ground. We'll get back to, actually, I'll come back to the Clifton College Close Ground later on in the podcast because there's a lot to say about that, but put a pin in that. We'll have a chat about this scorecard we've got here.
Yeah, so for this match, Gloucestershire won the toss, decided to bat, and put on a solid first innings total of 281, which was punctuated by Dippers, the Big Dippers, 61, and Townsend's 63. No particular figures of note for the Australian bowlers, although hashtag winning got 4 for 96. Australia then were put into bat and, well, they were dismissed at 447. And Charlie Parker, not the famous jazz musician, but however, he did indeed play a tune with the Australian batsman taking 7 for 70. Now, I just want to sort of hearken. I just want to, you know, interrupt here a little bit and talk about Charlie Parker because he is one of the, you know, those real sort of fascinating stories of the English county game.
Before we do that, we've got a fantasy team we can create here that we need to. We'll maybe do this on a White Line Wireless podcast in the future. But the Jazz 11.
The Jazz 11.
You have got Dizzy Gillespie. And
yes.
You've got Charlie Parker.
Yes, that's
and,
true.
So I'm sure we could dig some other names up out of there.
There are definitely some famous Armstrongs who played cricket.
Yeah, there's definitely Warwick Armstrong.
That's
so,
true.
You know, we could call him Louis.
Yes. I'm not aware of any Thelonious Monks who've played cricket, but feel free to correct me, listeners.
You know, but you've got some, there's, you know, lots of Fitzgeralds out
yes,
there.
Yes, true.
You have... well, anyway, we might save that for a White Line Wireless call. But yeah, tweet them in at us so that we can get that together ahead of time. But yep, Charlie Parker.
Yeah, Charlie Parker.
The cricketer, not the jazz legend.
Exactly right, because I don't know shit about jazz, as you can probably gather. But he was someone who played...
Well, you knew Thelonious Monk. That's not...
Yeah, but that's because he's got a cool name.
Yeah, pretty much.
Rightio. So Charlie Parker was someone who played for Gloucestershire for... Well, started in 1903, ended his career in 1935, but there was a war that got in the way. Mm. He played 635 games in total at first-class level and took an astonishing 3,278 first-class wickets.
Whoa.
At an average of 19.46. Was he good enough to play for England? Well, yes, he was, for a single test.
Huh.
He only played once in the 1921... series against Australia, did rather well. Bowled, you know, got 2 for 32, average of 16, solid first test. Never got to play again. And he was someone who just whiled away for 20-odd years at first-class level, consistently getting huge numbers of wickets every year, but never quite made it into the test match 11.
And he... Like so, most of his and like he's in his peak during the 20s, isn't he? And this is not a good English Test team. So,
it wasn't.
So I think there's got to be more to the Charlie Parker story.
We might have to come back to that another day. But
I think he must have pissed someone off.
Yeah, he did. I've read about Parker in the past, and he was someone who was a bit of a prickly character, and was not quite of the makeup, shall we say, to warrant selection in the rather buttoned-down teams of early 1920s England.
Just to put his near 3,300 wickets into context, that puts him third of all time.
Yes.
In first-class wickets. First, Wilfred Rhodes.
Who played for about 40 years.
Yeah,
so
he played 1,110 first-class matches.
Yes.
Titch Freeman.
Another player who played probably far too few test matches for his quality, another spinner as well, but also with an interesting personality.
And fourth is Jack Hearn.
Okay, yep.
So he's definitely up there with the greats, that's for sure.
There we go.
Yep. All right.
So back to the scorecard. So after the Jazz 11 and Charlie Parker dismissed Australia for 147, Australia were asked to follow on. And just another side point, because side points are what I do. Mm. I always love the phrasing of asked to follow on, as if you have a choice. Mm. It's like, would you like to follow on? Well, actually, I wasn't really feeling it. We quite struggled in that first innings. Do you mind if we field again? No, it doesn't work that way. You're being asked to follow on because you have failed, and they're reminding you that you have failed.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's one of those real obscure cricket things that a lot of people don't understand. It's, like I was talking to someone the other day about the whole idea of appealing, where, if you don't appeal,
and can't be out.
It can't be out. Yep. Yeah. Like, unless the batsman walks, which is, why walking is such a big thing. But if you hit the ball and it is very clearly caught, if you don't ask, if you don't ask the umpire,
never happened.
It never happened. However, of course, the same tradition and culture that brings about that also requires that you walk in that situation. So, that's why walking is such a big deal, because it goes to the fundamentals of the game.
Yeah. So anyway, in Australia's second innings following on, they struggled initially, and the big dipper.
Initially?
For the entirety of the innings, but it's a short innings. They struggled with the Big Dipper and Parker running through their top order. Australia at one stage were 5 for 25 and looking in dire straits of losing one of the few games they would lose on this tour. But the clerk of the weather does have a sense of humour and sent rain not too long after, with Australia at 5 for 64, and that was the last of the action that we would see on this match, ending in a draw.
Mm, and the Glaucs only won 4 games this season, so poor them, missing out on the win there, which they definitely should have got. So what were they 140, 134 ahead in the first innings, and Australia were 5 for 64.
Yep, so still 70-odd runs short, 5 wickets in hand. It was set up without rain for a fairly comfortable Gloucestershire victory, but yes.
Although this team was known for pulling matches out of the fire.
True.
So, and you do have Pelu and
Trenery.
And Trenery. Pelu and Trenery are there to, they're at the crease, so they can make runs. You still had Lampard to come in. He, one of the better batsmen. Sterling and Long could both, and winning. So they had depth, but They were through the main of the batting.
Yes.
But I think we can call that one definitely a lucky escape from the Australians.
Yes.
Okay. So before we go back and talk a little bit more about what is going on, we'll have a look at the Somerset game. So the very next day, they've made their way over to Taunton from Clifton.
And this time, Australia continued their poor form with a bat in the first innings and were dismissed all out for 85 after winning the toss and deciding to bat. This time it was Robson and White, that famous duo, I guess, of Somerset, who took 6 and 4 wickets respectively. But Australia managed to limit the damage by dismissing Somerset for 70. And Australia only needed 2 bowlers to take those wickets, and it was Collins and Winning.
In 32 overs, bowled them out in 32 overs. So.
Yep.
Whereas, close to 60 overs to get the Australians out. So, really ripped through them. I think it's probably fair to say that might have been a sticky wicket, that one.
Yes, I think it might have been by the look of it. So, Australia were back in now with a lead of 15. They settled on 4 wickets declared for 144. So, were mindful of time in this match. Put on at 44, left themselves about a 160 run lead. So, Collins there made a half century for Australia. But they needn't have worried, as they dismissed Somerset for 64 in this second innings. And again, Australia only needed to rely upon the 2 bowlers of Collins and Winning. Collins this time getting the spectacular figures of 8 for 31 in the second innings.
you want to know what's really the spectacular stat there, have a look at how they go out. There is four stumpings.
Bloody hell.
So Long was on fire.
If I was the coach of Somerset, you'd be bloody nailing their boots behind the crease to make sure that they weren't getting stumped. Four of them, and great effort by Ted Long, you're right.
Yeah, so I mean, think about how Bill Oldfield's got to be thinking at this point, because he's kept nearly, because Ted Long was the original keeper.
Yep.
Oldfield came in to replace him and has played nearly the whole series. Had a rest for this game, and just been absolutely shown up by...
Yeah, see, this is why you don't take rests. I mean, you don't want to give some other chump behind you a chance to show you up.
Yeah, especially for the wicketkeeper.
Well, exactly. And Ted Long was not a bad cricketer. Although, you know, for those of you who listen to this podcast, you'll know that Bert Oldfield, it ended up okay for him.
Yeah, he was all right.
He was a solid cricketer.
Yeah. I think Ted Long was a footy player as well. Yeah, I think it may also be reflective that they were really trying to get a result here. And so I think, as Krish would say, there would have been many lusty blows being played there. And I think that would explain the four stumpings. Four stumpings. Collins has got a caught and bowled as well. So really showed him up there. Okay. All right. So that actually finishes up the county season.
There we go.
That is it. We have a few more games to go for the Australians. So they play two games against South of England next week. And then the following week, they play C.I. Thornton's 11, which at the Scarborough Festival. And so that is fairly close to a full-strength England side. There's a few notable omissions there. So really only the representative games to go. That's the end of their county season. And part of the tradition at these cricket festivals is really having a bit of a party. And that's sort of where the rest of Cow Corner's diary this week takes us. So let's go back and see what's happening there. One of the features of our tour has been the hospitality of our hosts. In most counties, where time allowed, we were hosted by a range of local dignitaries, politicians and sportsmen. Our visits to the seaside towns of Clifton and Taunton for our final county games, while not spectacular from a cricket viewpoint, were exemplary for their conviviality and good fellowship. In particular, I would like to quote several speeches from our dinner at Taunton, which drove home precisely why we were here and why the cricket has been secondary to the duty to the empire. The Bishop of Taunton proposed the Imperial Forces and remarked that, quote, "We have learnt much during the last 5 years. Before the war, we had learnt a little of what our empire meant. We had learnt in those 5 years what we had to lose for the empire, but we had also learnt some of these things which we might win through the war, and that some of the things which we believed before the war to be truly were really so, that our empire was a known force. United as we had been, we had learnt in a wondrous way what it meant to the empire's strength. God grant that that strength might never decrease, but that we might remain united in peace as we had been in war. It was almost a byword how splendidly the empire responded when we were in trouble, and it was splendid the way they came to the call to the old mother country, and they went out to fight side by side together and learnt that we were indeed of one blood and one great nation and empire. We had a great vision before us of what the empire might be in the future now that the war had so bound it together. That's the end of the quote. He only wished that as with cricket, so might it be with politics, that our politicians might run as straight and play the game as straight as the cricketers from Australia did and had done, and then it would be good for our old empire, both beyond the seas and at home."
Jeez, I wonder if the Bishop of Taunton sort of daylighted as a politician, because that's such a politician's speech, full of buzzwords and calls to action and inspirational language, but saying absolutely nothing.
So he, Bishop of Taunton is a fairly
senior, I think, role.
Yeah, because it's in the Diocese of Canterbury. It is a fairly senior. He would have been probably involved in. He would have been political, I would imagine. That would have been quite common at that point. But this isn't even political. There is a growing labour movement. There is a growing sense of working class identity and those things. But and we're going to talk about this in a later podcast while the boys are on the water. But this really is just the general attitude of the upper social classes, definitely the middle and upper classes. But what really was the English attitudes toward empire. I wanted to include this quote, and I wanted to include it in its entirety, because there are so many things in there that really go to not so much with the story I'm trying to tell with these cricketers, but about how where Australian identity is at this point. And I've made the comment a few times during the podcast about how before the war, so especially up until, really is up until the war breaks out, but from 1890 through to 1910 is kind of what I call sort of peak Australian identity. That's the point when Australians are the most Australian possibly that they've ever been, more so than even today, in terms of having this identity as something separate to somewhere else, and that it is really the war that brings Australia back into the empire. Not back into the empire, but brings Australian identity back to being a British identity. So a lot of the national identity that leads to Federation, for example, gets wiped out by the war. There's a couple of great quotes in there. The war has bound the empire together, they've learned what they had to lose for the empire, but we've also now seen what we've got to gain by the empire. And because England, for the first time, realised if it wasn't for the empire, we wouldn't have been able to fight this war. If it wasn't for Canadian and Australian and South African and especially Indian troops, we would not. Because the English army was pretty much all wiped out on day one. What battle is that? The Somme? I don't think it's the Somme. First big battle?
Yeah, the first big battle they got into was the Marne, I think it was. Battle of the Marne in 1914. And yes, a lot of their professional army was
pretty much the entirety of the British expeditionary forces was wiped out, which is about 100,000 men. And they formed, so there was this great big line, which is up the border between France and Germany, and then across Belgium, and the English had taken up that wing, the left wing, sort of between the coast and the French forces.
Yep.
And there was a point where they could have evacuated and saved some of their army, but it was decided not to, and they were just absolutely, absolutely wiped out there, and obviously had a large population to draw a conscription army from. But it wasn't just the conscription armies; it wasn't just the people coming out of the empire. It was, all of the wheat and wool coming out of Canada and Australia, and all of the money coming out of India. But yeah, the resources of the empire was what enabled them to take on and defeat.
The other use for England of the imperial forces was that it enabled England, or Britain at that time, to fight upon multiple fronts, because the New Deal army that was formed by Kitchener, made out of conscription forces, was largely utilised in Europe. But the strength of the empire was allowing Britain to have forces in a wide range of theatres which the Central Powers could not match. Mm. So South African troops and other African colonial troops were being utilised to harass the German colonies of Tanganyika, Cameroon at that time in Central Africa.
Yep.
Australian, New Zealand troops were utilised at the start of the war to claim German territories in the South Pacific.
Yep.
Exactly right. And basically closed down those shipping lanes. Indian troops were utilised quite a lot in Africa as well, but also utilised a lot in the Middle East.
Mm.
So having the colonial forces enabled Britain to really sort of hone their forces where they were most needed in
Europe.
Fight
a world war.
Exactly, to fight a world war in a way that the Central Powers couldn't quite manage.
Mm. I'm not a great expert on this. I'm researching a little bit for the book, but South Africa in involvement in the war. I know it was very contentious.
Yes.
And because, of course, you have the Union in 1910 and you've got Smuts and Botha, who are both Afrikaan.
Yep.
Who get together and form this, you know, the first sort of leadership of early South Africa. And to their credit, they saw, they had to actually convince their own party that they shouldn't, because their own party wanted to join with the Central Powers.
Yep.
Very much. And to their own credit, they saw that that would be the end of the Union they'd just put together, and that they were much better off. Much better off keeping all of the English in South Africa on side by fighting. But they, I don't think they actually sent any troops to Europe at all, at least not until much later. And it is the King's African Rifles that go up and fight these battles in East Africa on the German possessions there. So
exactly.
Okay, we might have another speech. Because after the Bishop of Taunton's very nice words on the importance of empire, and also I like he only wished that, as with cricket, so it might be with politics, that politicians might run as straight and play the game as straight as the cricketers from Australia did. And I quite like that. That's, nothing ever changes, does it?
No.
We always think our politicians are dodgy, and maybe there's a point where you've got to say, "Well, you've probably got to be a bit dodgy to be a politician, don't you?" And I think running a country also involves you being a little bit dodgy. So I should never let them off the hook, but just be aware that that's going to always happen. Okay, Captain Docker responded on behalf of the Australians and said that the Australian Imperial Forces were in a rather unique position, as they were only force that was composed entirely of volunteers. Their force consisted of roughly 400,000 men. And his hearers might think that this was a large number to come forward as volunteers, but if they lived in Australia, they would not wonder at that, for the whole of Australia was actuated by intense loyalty to the British Empire, and they always spoke of the mother country as home. They in Australia had practically no army and knew nothing of war, and they came over here as learners. But they were most cordially received by the officers of the British Army, and any advice and help they asked for was freely given. He hoped there would be no more wars, but he could assure them if the mother country was in need again, she would not find Australia wanting. The Australian cricketers, like thousands of Australian wounded soldiers, will have very pleasant recollections of Bristol. Bristol was one of the major hospitals, so they were quite used. Thoughts on that? Though I definitely have something I want to bring up on that.
Oh, lead the way.
So, I love this. I love this idea. If they lived in Australia, that not wondered that for the whole of Australia was actuated by intense loyalty to the British Empire. If you know anything about Australian history of World War One, you will know that the conscription debate was very intense, and if you have done any a little bit more on Australian history, it's not something we get into at like a primary or a high school level, but the labour riots that are going on at this stage and the support for Ireland that is going on at this stage, and it is quite divided. As I was saying, 1910, you've got this real peak Australian identity, and then this war comes along. And really, by the end of it, it's sort of peak British identity. But through it all, there is a fight over who Australia is through the whole war. That's best represented by the conscription debates. But our parliaments keep falling apart. You have parties forming out of everywhere. You know, you've got Billy Hughes just trying to be the dictator of Australia. And yes, so there is a lot of what destroys that first Hughes government is Billy Hughes' just unwavering commitment to England. And the whole, you know, the rest of the Labor Party is like, well, no, our commitment should actually be to the working people of Australia and not to what was, you know, because the attitude of working people, the labor movement in World War One was that World War One was essentially capitalists and aristocrats fighting each other over who got the most money and using all of the working classes to do it.
Yep.
Which essentially it was. And so it's, I think the point I wanted to make here was that it's very representative, I think, of the composition of this team, which is a lot of officers. So if you compare the demographics of this team, so education levels, religion, that kind of thing, it matches onto the officer class almost identically. But if you compare it to the demographics of either the AIF or Australia as a whole, there's not, I think, one or two Catholics. And
yeah,
you know, that's very unusual because at this stage, a quarter of Australia is Catholic. So it's one of these things, and I'm going to write about this in later depth, about the demographics of this team, because it really shows up that cricket is quite an elitist sport in Australia. As much as there's this myth of it being the national game and being something that everyone does, and definitely, you know, 50s, 60s and 70s, that is much, much more of an argument can be made about that. But it was a game played by private school kids in the city.
Yep.
Essentially.
It was.
By Anglicans, you know, by Protestants. Private school Protestants in the city was who was a cricketer, by and large. You know, Adelaide, and especially Adelaide and Sydney, and to a lesser degree, Melbourne. But
and it's interesting that you mentioned the impact of religion there, because that was obviously one of the key drivers in the conscription vote as well. Australia divided quite directly down religious lines.
Yes,
with Protestants being much more likely to vote for conscription in order to support what they saw quite directly as the mother country, whereas the quarter of Australians were Catholic.
Because they're not Italian Catholics, they're not Polish Catholics.
They're Irish Catholics. Exactly. And obviously the background of that at the time and what was going on with Ireland really heavily motivated the Catholic population of Australia to vote against what they saw as imperial overreach.
Yeah, you know, so the first conscription plebiscite happens months after the Easter Uprising,
yes,
which is the start of the Irish War of Independence. So that's, you know, it has to be really, really put into that context that is what's going on, and which ties in really nicely to 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago's story about these guys who were going AWOL to fight for the IRA. That, you know, so much of that history, and the, because of course you haven't heard it, Cam, but there's no evidence of this ever happening in any Australian war records. And the only reason that we kind of suspected that probably happened is that there was one researcher who had some family history, and then he went and checked the New Zealand archives, and there's records of Kiwis doing it.
Okay.
And it's like, if Kiwis did it, Australians probably did it too. So it's quite interesting that there is zero record of it happening. And, you know, this guy was researching out of ANU, and that's where the Defence Force Academy is. And,
yep.
And so he had the best defence scholars there helping him. And the word was that, yep, that looks like those records were destroyed. So, so it's a interesting part of Australian history. And World War One is the Irish question, and it's something that we tend to ignore in our general histories. And I don't think it's anything too conspiratorial. I think it's just that there's more important things to learn about in regards to World War One.
Agree.
And so it gets missed a lot, but yeah, it's there. Okay, so we've got one little bit more from Cow Corner. Okay, so getting back to the Clifton College close ground. Open up Wikipedia and have a look at Clifton College close ground.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And go through and read, Clifton Close College. Not the ground, the Clifton College.
Oh, okay.
Go and have a scan through some of the names at the alumni there. So we'll just go back and see what Cow Corner has to say. Oh, this was about the Glaucs game, but we've already spoken about that scorecard, which is fine. The Gloucestershire game was played at the famous Clifton College Close Ground, the close of Vitae Lampada fame, as well as the alma mater of C.E.W. Bean, Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, and General William Birdwood. So in terms of Australian World War I history, that is... Monash didn't go there. but at our dinner there, those who had fallen in the war were remembered in a silent toast. It is to those who sacrificed it all in playing up and playing the greatest game that I wish to dedicate the remainder of this week's column. I'm now going to read out Vitae Lampada by a poet called Henry Newbolt. And just a little bit of context before I read it. So this was written in the 1870s. So it was during the war in the Sudan, became quite a popular thing in the First World War as not just a propaganda, but also it was much mocked and parodied. But here it is. There's a breathless hush in the close tonight. 10 to make and the match to win. A bumping pitch and a blinding light. An hour to play and the last man in. And it's not for the sake of a ribboned coat or the selfish hope of a season's fame, but his captain's hand on his shoulder smote. Play up, and play the game. The sand of the desert is sodden red, red with the wreck of a square that broke. The Gatling's jammed and the colonel dead, and the regiment blind with dust and smoke. The river of death has brimmed his banks, and England's far and honour a name. But the voice of a schoolboy rallies the ranks. Play up, and play the game. This is the word that year by year, while in her place the school is set, every one of her sons must hear, and none that hears it dare forget. This they all with a joyful mind bear through life like a torch in flame, and falling fling to the host behind, play up, and play the game. So there's an apocryphal saying that Wellington who defeated Napoleon?
At Waterloo, yes.
The Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton.
Yes, that's right.
And the idea there being that that's where officers were trained was in sports. And it seems like that's not actually, that seems like came later, probably out of this mid-century idea. Because, of course, in 1812, we're still a little bit before the whole muscular Christianity of mid-19th century England, which is really the dominant cultural trope of England from about 1850 through till the First World War.
Yes.
And so much of that is, and what this poem was about, was saying basically that, you know, the reason why England's armies are able to conquer the world is because of the lessons that are learnt on the playing fields of Eton. Essentially, you know, there is a, even though it's talking about schoolboys and that there is it is implicit here that they are talking about public schoolboys, which of course, you know, so grammar schools or private schools, and it sort of becomes this sort of call in the First World War as well, you know, remember what made the Empire great, remember what made us great, remember what made us great. But, you know, it's a much... Because the sand of the desert is sodden red, red with the wreck of the square that broke. So that's an actual... That's a reference to an actual battle in this war in Sudan, when, you know, 100 soldiers held off 10,000 or something.
Yeah, it was a few more soldiers than that. I mean, the Battle of Abu Klea is what they're referring to, and it's bit over 1,000, right, yeah, soldiers, but yeah, still holding off, 13 or 14 times their strength in Sudanese fighters.
And it's one of those. It's like the one in against the Zulu as well.
Yeah, Battle of Rorke's Drift.
Yeah,
yes.
Yep. So they have become very much part of the English myth, and this English superiority is that they were able to. It was the fact that they were gentlemen of honour who took the values of the cricket field out onto the battlefield, and that's why they were able to, defeat armies that were orders of magnitude bigger than they were, and not the Gatling.
Yes.
which arguably is the main reason.
Yes. I mean, I've got a lot of thoughts about this, which I won't go into in depth because, we only have so long. But the battles against Napoleon, go to Waterloo, were not won through any sense of British schoolboy superiority, but due to the tactical errors made by a general who was fading from his previous strength. Yep. Napoleon should have possibly won Waterloo, but made some key tactical errors throughout the day, and various diseases that he was suffering from was probably clouding his judgment and been in decline as a commander from about 1809 onwards. Mm. And in terms of the colonial victories that occurred in the second half of the 19th century, yeah, it wasn't the playing grounds of school fields that determined these victories. It was the factories of the north. It was the shipyards of Southampton and Liverpool that helped create English dominance. It was their mechanical and industrial advances throughout the 18th and 19th centuries that created English dominance over the world and created them and allowed them to keep an empire.
Mm. So keep an empire with an army of 100,000.
Exactly.
It is incredible.
Yep.
And I read something recently, or had a conversation with someone recently. It was about the whole the way the English were able to co-opt local power structures, and able to hold India with 15,000 men or something.
Yep.
It is insane.
Yes.
And that was because they were able to co-opt local power structures and that kind of thing.
Now, English diplomacy was truly underrated over that period as well.
Mm.
When people think of the might of the English Empire, there is often a quite strong focus upon the Navy, and rightfully so. The Navy was key to maintaining that empire. And industry to a certain degree is emphasised in their ability to maintain it. Obviously, trade. This whole concept of muscular Christianity, but British diplomacy and the British Foreign and Imperial Office is hugely underrated in what they're able to achieve, because you're exactly right. The smartest thing that England often did in terms of working their way into countries was to play off the respective power brokers in their countries against each other, favour one side of that and use those men as their own in terms of establishing a hold, create a sense of loyalty in a percentage of the population, and then help that percentage rise to power and allow you to create a protectorate or a territory.
Yeah. And I mean, it's much the same as what the US Empire is built on as well. It's very much the same, compared to like the Soviet Empire, which was a very much more militaristic.
It was,
Backed by, because it's a land empire, it's much easier to do that. It's interesting that you mentioned not the Foreign Office. What was the Department of Colonial Affairs?
Yes, that's right.
One of my colleagues last year, he was English. He came and worked at my institution for the year. He was working. He works on documents from the Colonial Office. And it was the center of the world. Like every single bit of correspondence of the empire passed through that office.
Yep.
So if you were sending something from the governor of West Indies to the governor of Bombay, it went through London. And so it's recorded there. And it is just the most incredible treasure trove for the historian. He was working on on slavery. So he picks three dates in the 19th century that are important for slavery, and he's just going through like an entire year's worth of correspondence from there, and mapping trends and things like that. But it's interesting that you talk about the diplomacy, because that's something that doesn't really get brought up very often, and it's not something that I really think about very much, but it's definitely there. But the other thing is the bureaucracy. The power of the English bureaucracy is that's what it was, because it was a bureaucratic trading empire. It wasn't a military.
It wasn't a military empire, no.
No, it was, you know, it was about having trading posts and enough room around them to protect them, and then having resources. Exactly. Access to resources, so
they needed a navy to protect those shipping lanes, which is why the British Navy had such an outsized importance. Mm. But the army only existed as a small professional force, which was effectively like a firefighting force.
Yeah.
In the respect that you know, if anything ever flared up or any major issues occurred, the army could be relied upon to help put down local revolts. Mm. Or to support allies in times of need, but that's all that they were intended to be.
Yeah, they're the expeditionary force. They weren't an occupational force.
Exactly right. Mm. And in terms of, the diplomacy is so important, not just in terms of them maintaining an empire, but also the way they phrased it was maintaining a balance of power in Europe.
Mm.
Britain's aim was to ensure that no two countries, when aligned together, could ever be stronger than Britain.
Mm.
So they would consistently play alliances off each other to prevent any one power becoming overly strong. And to just use the Napoleonic Wars as an example, Britain recognised early on the threat of France, but was obviously unable to threaten France militarily.
Mm.
But what they did, they bankrolled, coerced Austria, Prussia, Russia at various times. Because when you look at the seven coalitions that that were created at various times to combat Napoleon, the one constant to each of those coalitions was Britain.
Yep.
And it wasn't a contribution that they made through armed forces. It was a contribution they made through money.
Yeah, and they funded a Swedish army for quite some time.
Yep,
and
they did.
Yeah, but it's... Talking about Napoleon has reminded me of something. I was having a conversation with one of my students this week, and the subject that we're doing at the moment is American Civil Rights Movement. And one of the questions we're examining in that subject is whether individuals like Martin Luther King are the real important prime mover, or whether it was the movement as a whole is the prime mover. And it's one of these conversations we have in history is, how important are individual actors compared to just general conditions, and of course the most important thing being random shit. And the way I was explaining it to him was Napoleon this great general, or was he able to walk across Europe because Europe was it was very fractured, there was no sort of central power over there. It was a bunch of smaller states, and it's one of those things where it's like if there had have been a unified sort of Germany by that point, would Napoleon have been able to defeat?
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, so
probably
if he,
not
if he had to come up against. But as you said, one of the reasons why Europe was so fractured at that point was English diplomacy keeping things fractured so that no one got powerful enough to...
Yeah, and also Germany was a weird place at the time. There were still the remnants of the Holy Roman Empire, which I would love to talk about, but I'm mindful that I've already talked way too much about European history in this episode.
I guess that we probably have. That's sort of about all the time we've got for this week. It's great having Cam along, because don't hold back from talking about this, because this is what you're really bringing to the table in this podcast, is that even though technically I'm the historian, I think a lot of the general knowledge, you've actually got a lot more depth than me, especially European 19th century history. I'm pretty bad with that, to be honest with you. That's kind of the service that I'm trying to provide here, is to give some deep context and understanding around these events, as well as give you a little bit of entertainment in the form of these diaries, which remember you can find at anthonycondon.com, and you can tweet at me at anthcondon. And anything else you'd like to add for this week, Cam?
No, I think I've more than said enough.
Yep, I think I have too. And so we will leave it there. Thank you for listening and we'll see you next week. Goodbye. Cricket, cricket, all the way. We got it deep in our DNA. So when they start to play and you want to know, bloody ball. The main of every true blue fan is the Badex cricketer anchorman. It's the same old words in the same old voice. Long past time there was another choice, like the white line wireless.
White line wireless.
White line wireless.
White line wireless.
From the box of dreams you're gonna hear the call.
Oh, bob, bloody ball.